Well, the world looks a little different today, doesn't it? At least if you live in mid-Michigan, the Lansing area. The governor says he will sign the $1.2 billion road funding package passed by the Senate and the House yesterday. New faces on the Lansing City Council and the East Lansing City Council, and we are expecting to talk with Mark Meadows, Shanna Dreheim, and Eric Altman in about a half an hour. And in case you were on the edges of your seats, according to MLive, Todd Corser and Cindy Gamrat were, quote, crushed in their bids to rejoin the legislature. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us today. In the early 20th century, a new type of journalist emerged. The muckraker sought to expose corruption and exploitation, often by going undercover. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich has become famous for her modern-day muckraking. For her 2001 book, Nickel and Dime, she explored the impact of 1990s welfare reforms by taking low-wage jobs and living off her meager earnings. She has since become an outspoken critic of the rising income inequality in the United States. But Ehrenreich didn't start out as a writer or an activist. In fact, she actually earned her Ph.D. in cellular immunology. I had a chance to talk with Ehrenreich ahead of her lecture on American inequality at the Kellogg Auditorium in East Lansing this evening, so I started out by asking her why she made the switch from science to writing.
I just got tired of laboratory work. Not of science. I'm still very much a science appreciator, you could call me, but I was not really great in a lab. And so I did many things, and I eventually found I was a writer.
Your book, Nickel and Dimed, was published in 2001 and explored the impact of the welfare reform of the 1990s on the working poor. You dove into this topic by taking low-wage jobs in Florida and Maine and trying to get by on the wages of the working poor. Why did you want to do this as an immersive experience rather than a more traditional kind of journalism where you're interviewing the people in those jobs?
Well, I'm not sure I wanted to. I was talking with a magazine editor about the assumption that if somebody gets a job, everything's all right. You know, they'll take care of their families and so on. And I was just pointing out, you know, you can see what is being offered as wages in entry-level jobs. And then you can turn the page of the newspaper. In those cases, we had newspapers, and see what the rents were. And the math did not look good. So he suggested, he said, why don't you go and try it? Try it for yourself.
Was there a point at which you regretted doing the first-person approach as opposed to the more traditional kind of journalism?
Well, yeah, it was hard work. The work was hard. Waitressing, house cleaning, hotel housekeeping, nursing home aide, Walmart associate. Work was very hard, but I think I found out some things I would not have found out if I had just interviewed in the traditional way.
Like what?
Like I found out how hard the work is. I mean, I'm a strong person. I've always been very fit, but sometimes after the end of a shift, my legs would feel like rubber. It was, you know, it was a challenge, physically and intellectually, keeping track of so many things. It was kind of overwhelming.
Nickel and Dimed was published almost 15 years ago. The economy has gone through the worst recession since the Great Depression in those years. How have you seen the conditions for low-wage workers change during that time?
Well, conditions have changed for the worse in many ways. To me, one of the most alarming trends is away from any kind of control over your own schedule at work. I mean, there are employers who want you to come in when they want you, but they're not going to pay for you to hang around anytime. They don't actually want you most. So you have to be by your phone, waiting to get called in. You have no idea how much work you're going to get in any one day or week, if any work. That's called sort of just-in-time scheduling. Mm-hmm. And this is very destructive. You can't plan. You can't arrange your child care. So that's one of the most alarming trends.
During the Great Recession, the economy collapsed not just for blue-collar workers, but for many white-collar and middle-class workers as well. Do you think that in the wake of the recession, that more people are paying attention to the issue of inequality?
Yes. So I don't know if it's totally the recession itself that sparked the attention. I think one of the big turning points was the Occupy movement in 2011. Which made this a major issue. You know, you really could not talk about inequality very easily in this country before that, because there's always been a taboo. You know, then in the 50s and well into the 60s, it was the idea that America is a classless society. You know, that class differences are something that go on in Europe, not here. And it was really kind of unpatriotic to suggest that wasn't true. But we're way past that now. And, you know, if you look at I don't advise really looking at all of it, the presidential debates, and you know, it's something that even some Republicans have to deal with. And it's certainly the big issue going on the Democratic side.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the award-winning author of Nickel and Dimed, Bait and Switch, Bright-Sided, and Living with a Wild God. She joins us ahead of a lecture at the Kellogg Auditorium on MSU's campus this evening. There does seem to be increasing momentum for raising the minimum wage in states across the country. Do you think that there's enough political will to make those changes nationwide?
I think so. I'm sorry that Barack Obama hasn't kept his promises on that. But yeah, I think there's plenty of them. This is something that most Americans absolutely agree on, that the minimum wage is too low, and that low wage working people deserve the chance to live decently too.
Is it just about policy, or do you see a need for cultural changes too?
Well, in a sense, I mean, the cultural change I would like to see most immediately is respect for people's work. I mean, there is a tendency in this country among the affluent, and they're not terribly affluent, to ignore the huge amount of work and sacrifice and effort that goes into feeding us, clothing us, getting us around, and so on. These people become invisible, and I want to change that.
I want to spend a little time talking about your newest book. It's a memoir called Living with a Wild God, and it was inspired by a journal that you kept as an adolescent. And in that journal, you wrote about several unexplainable experiences you had as a young person. Can you describe what those experiences were like?
Not too easy. We'll say perceptual alterations, which I was, you know, was sort of put out of my mind or in a corner of my mind for decades and decades. And then a point came a few years ago when I thought, you know, I'm sort of a scientist in the way I think. I've got to return. I can't have some unexplained phenomenon in my life forever. I've got to see what this was about.
I think some of our listeners are eager to hear at least the basics about one of these inexplicable experiences. Can you share one with us?
Well, you know, this is not something I sought or cultivated. I had no idea of, like, meditation or achieving altered states. I have really no idea of these things. So it was a complete surprise when I began to see things differently, even blazingly differently, even shatteringly differently for short periods of time. And what I discovered in working on this book is that was hardly unique to me. Many people have unclassifiable, so-called mystical experiences, which they may fold into religion and say that must have been in a religious experience. I couldn't do that because I wasn't religious. I just had no way of thinking that way. So this is an unbeliever's attempt to understand such things.
One of the entries in those journals reads, and I'll quote, "I write this from a sense of duty, a feeling of obligation to my future self, whom I implore to read with compassion. What will I be, the person who, months later, reads this? Myself, the same as ever? What have you learned since you wrote this? Unquote. Now, what were you thinking when you read that line so many years later?
Well, I was moved by it. Because here's a, you know, how often you get a letter from your, say, 16-year-old self. And because I had this journal, I did have this communication from my younger self. I imagined myself reading it only a few months later after writing it. But in fact, it was decades later, practically a lifetime later. And have I changed? Well, yeah, a lot of things happened in 50 years.
It took you a long time to write about these experiences. Was there something that was holding you back?
Yeah. People would think I was crazy. You know, that's the obvious in saying I've had some peculiar mystical experiences. I mean, the conversation doesn't go far from there usually.
Are you thinking about the next topic you want to tackle in your writing yet?
I'm writing another book now.
Can you tell us about it?
Well, this is a book that kind of takes on the whole idea that you should be doing everything possible to extend your life. You know, in our culture, it's the fitness culture, which I am a member of, I will have to admit. It's the emphasis on the almost, I would call it, neurotic emphasis on what you eat, on is it healthy? Huge amounts of worries, especially as you get to be in your 40s and 50s, you could be spending most of your time, or a lot of your time every day, just doing things to extend your own life. Not enjoy it, not do great things, but just live longer. And I'm taking that on.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the award-winning author of Nickel and Dimed, Bait and Switch, Bright-Sided, and Living with a Wild God. She'll be giving a lecture this evening at the Kellogg Auditorium in East Lansing at 7, and will be part of a panel discussion tomorrow at the Arca Theater from 5 till 7 p.m. Barbara Ehrenreich, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Graduating high school and preparing for college can be stressful for any student, but for the ones who also face financial or socioeconomic hardships, it can be an overwhelming challenge. On Neighbors in Action this week, we're looking at an organization that partners with motivated students to meet the challenge together. Upward Bound is a federally funded educational program that provides academic enrichment to disadvantaged high schoolers. Joining us today is the director of Upward Bound at Michigan State University, Glenda Hammond, and Deborah Thornton, a former Upward Bound student. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Glenda, what qualifies a student for the Upward Bound program?
Well, 2/3 of our population must be both low income and first generation. And then we do look at those students who have the potential to succeed. And it doesn't mean that they are in the top 10% of their class. But as we look at their transcripts, their test scores, and teacher recommendations, we can determine that this student has the potential to succeed, but needs the kind of support that Upward Bound offers.
And that's the other third? That's the other one-third?
That's the two-thirds.
That's the two-thirds.
Right. The one-third can be either first, they all are first generation, but either first generation or low income or persons with a disability.
And what specifically do students receive assistance with once they're accepted?
Once they're accepted, and I should first say that the success of Upward Bound is based on our holistic approach. Mm. So students will receive academic enrichment, cultural enrichment, social and personal development, academic advising, curriculum advising, and counseling. And then, of course, along with some other services that we offer, we give them a campus living experience every year that they're in the program. They also get a chance to travel on what we call major study trips to different parts of the country because most of our students have not actually been out of Michigan.
That's a rich variety of services
yes,
you offer here.
Yes.
Deborah, I've got to talk to you about your experience. What was the process of applying to Upward Bound like for you?
What was the process?
Yeah.
Well, I'll probably answer more than what you just asked. But,
well, that's fine.
Okay. One of the things that I remember applying, and I did not get accepted in the program at ninth grade, and usually it's ninth grade when you start off. But I did apply because I was aware of the Upward Bound program and the services and so forth that was available.
Mm-hmm.
I applied, but I was on the waiting list. And so it was just a matter of waiting to see if I would be a part of it. One of the things, so it was just that process of waiting. One of the things I found out later, and probably, well, Glenda could elaborate a little bit more, I was on the waiting list. I was not the first on the waiting list. I probably was closest in the bottom of the list because of, you know, students wanting to be a part of it. But I just would frequently call Ms. Hammond and just ask, you know, any status. There was no openings and so forth. And I'm not sure exactly how long I waited, but I did wait.
Mm-hmm.
And then she did contact me to tell me that there was a availability. And at that point, I was invited and I was excited to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. What made Deborah qualified for the program, Glenda?
Well, she is from a first-generation low-income family.
Okay.
She was not accepted initially because her GPA did not show that she had the potential.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like what she wrote in her student profile. They do have to write an essay. So I put her on the waiting list. And then Deborah's persistence is what helped her to get into the program, because in my mind, I was saying, well, I don't want to say no completely, but I'm going to put her on the waiting list. I told her to call back in a couple of weeks. She called back exactly when I told her to.
Mm.
And then when I said call back in another couple of weeks, she called back exactly when I told her to. Finally,
a good sign.
Finally, I said, this student is really motivated. I can't lose.
I'm reminded of Woody Allen's line, half of life is just showing up. You know, just call back when we ask you to call back and you're halfway there. We're speaking with the director of Upward Bound at MSU, Glenda Hammond, and Deborah Thornton, a former Upward Bound student. Where did you attend high school?
J.W. Sexton High School.
Sexton High School. Mm-hmm. You're a local
yes.
Young woman.
Class of 85.
So after you got into Upward Bound, you attended college?
Yes. The audience can't see this, but I just it just brings tears to my eyes because of the potential and Glenda taking a chance on me. Bear with me.
Yeah.
But again, I they helped direct me. They saw the potential. They believed in me even before I completely believed in myself. So
understood.
I am here today because of Glenda, the Upward Bound program, the guidance, the spark to go to college, to think about college, to go beyond high school. They really did instill that, impart that. And I'm so ever appreciative for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that the potential that and just the direction that Glenda has guided me to where I am at today, even the young people that I work with currently, is to help them and to be that motivation and to stick with young people regardless of where they're status may be on paper.
Where they're coming from.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to ask. I mean, Glenda's talked about this holistic approach and the wide variety of kind of input and services that they offer. Have you ever isolated one or two that really made the most impact on you, or is it really a combination of all?
I would say it's a combination
things?
Of all. You need all of it in order to go forth and develop and grow. So it's a holistic approach, which the holistic approach works. And that's what I needed and other young people need, looking at it from a holistic. Every part is important and equally valuable.
You must feel tremendous hearing this. I mean,
oh,
there
yes.
must be other stories like Deborah's here.
Oh, yes.
A rewarding job that you have. What do you do now, Deborah?
I have been at Michigan State University for 24 years. I work as the lead academic coordinator in the East Engagement Advising Office. I work with freshmen, primarily freshmen and sophomore students, helping them from career exploration to course selection, transitioning from high school to college. I coordinate the academic orientation program for our no preference students, you know, assist students with major changes, any type of administrative responsibility. Our office and what I do is help facilitate that for incoming students.
And you graduated
and
from MSU.
And I graduated from MSU.
Okay, so this has just been a...
I graduated from MSU in 1990. I did an internship in the Lansing School District, and I was able to work with young children, similar program that were low income targeted students, just to help them get the skills that they needed in reading and math. And then from there, I got a position as a learning specialist in the athletic department. So I worked with student athletes from April 1991 through September 1997. So 6.5 years, and then I've been in the current unit that I'm in, the Undergraduate University Division, now is the Neighborhood Student Success Collaborative. I've been there since 1997, working with all students. So I have an opportunity and to help young people, wherever stage that they're at, to develop, and largely how Glenda helped me.
You're paying it forward.
Yes. I'm able to do that now to all students.
Yeah. Deborah Thornton is a former Upward Bound student. We're also talking with the director of Upward Bound at Michigan State University, Glenda Hammond. Glenda, I understand you've just started recruiting 9th and 10th graders for the year. What do you do to recruit them?
Well, because we're a federally funded program, we are required to make sure that the Lansing area, and this is our target area, we serve the three Lansing area high schools. So we are required to make sure that the entire Lansing community knows that we are recruiting. So we will, of course, this is a great opportunity here to let the community know that we are recruiting. We will go to the community centers, the churches, and the newspapers to let the community know that we are recruiting. We have contact counselors at the high schools, and we start working with them. We've already started working with them to advertise in the schools that we are recruiting students.
And what do the numbers show in terms of how successful Upward Bound at MSU has been at helping students graduate high school, let's say? Do the numbers back you up? The numbers really validate the mission here?
I would say that 95% and upwards of our students actually graduate from high school and are enrolled.
How many go to college?
And actually enroll in college.
95% graduate and end up enrolling for college. How about that?
On average, yes. And we're talking 49 years.
Hmm. Wow. What an impact. What opportunities do you have for volunteers? Because this is Neighbors in Action. This is about volunteers.
I'm really happy that you asked that question, because I didn't get to some of the other services. We have a mentoring program for our students, and mentoring is very important to our students. So college students and professionals can actually assist us in mentoring our students and providing them with information about college, about different careers, and so on. So mentoring is something that we are trying to encourage the professional community and the college community to engage in with the Upward Bound students. Community service also is a requirement of our students, because, as Deborah said, it's important to give back. So all of our students have to engage in community service 3 hours a week, 3 hours a month, excuse me. They're required to go out into the community and provide a service, of course, that they are not getting paid for or getting credit for. And so we help them to look at places like the Foster Community Center, Southside Coalition, Crystal Ray, the Advent House, different places like that where they can go into their own communities and give back, starting right now.
Mm. We've been speaking with the director of Upward Bound at MSU, Glenda Hammond, along with Deborah Thornton, a former Upward Bound student. Glenda, Deborah, thank you for being here. Continued success.
Thank you, Mark.
Current State is always looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little about why you think they should be featured. Coming up on Current State, in an unexpected turn of events, East Lansing Mayor Nathan Triplett has lost his seat on the East Lansing City Council, finishing fourth. We talked to the three people who beat him out for City Council seats, Mark Meadows, Shanna Draheim, and Eric Altman. Plus, WKAR's Peter Wharf and MSU professor Marcia McDowell explore the history and art of Chinese quilts at the MSU Museum. Stay tuned. .5 WKAR in Current State. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Yesterday was Election Day in Lansing and East Lansing, and in both cities there will be some new faces on their respective city councils. In Lansing's at-large city council race, incumbent Carol Wood won re-election. She'll be joined by newcomer Patricia Spitzley as an at-large member. Adam Hussein ousted incumbent Aylin Bowles in the first ward. He joins his mother, Jody Washington, on the council. She was reelected in the third ward. Lansing voters also approved an amendment to the city charter, placing new restrictions on contracts awarded to at-will city employees. Now in East Lansing, Mayor Nathan Triplett lost his bid to stay on the city council, finishing fourth in a race for three seats. The top vote-getters were Mark Meadows, Shanna Draheim, and Eric Altman, who all joined me here in Studio S. I'll point out that we spoke with Nathan Triplett a little bit ago. He expressed pride in the campaign his team ran, and he wished the newly elected council members good luck.
There's been, over my 8 years on council, a real change in the tone of the community dialogue, especially over the course of the last 2 years, and throughout that time, and sort of the rise of the negativity and the personal attacks, I'm very proud that we've stayed focused on results for the community and on a positive vision for our future. So in that regard, I have no regrets, and I'm looking forward to doing what I can in a different capacity to help keep East Lansing moving in the right direction.
Former East Lansing Mayor Nathan Triplett, we want to welcome all three victors here, though, to a Current State. Mark Meadows, Shanna Draheim, and Eric Altman, welcome. Good to see all of you. Congratulations.
Hey, thanks. Thank you.
We did reach out to all five of the non-incumbents running for East Lansing City Council to appear on the show today, intending to talk with those who would be new to the council. You're all here. Aside from whatever optimism you might have had about your own chances to win a seat on the council, did any of you expect Nathan Triplett to finish fourth and lose his seat?
Well, I guess I could say that during the last 2 weeks of the campaign, the polling that was done during that time period did indicate that Nathan had dropped to fourth place in the polling. Polling doesn't mean anything until a vote takes place, but the vote last night was reflected by the polling, and that drop seemed to start almost immediately after the negative campaigning in the community began by the chamber. So I think that you can link the two of those together, that prior to that time, Nathan seemed to poll in second place pretty consistently, but there was a precipitous drop after that negative campaigning began.
We'll point out, Nathan is still going to be mayor for a while, so you will be sworn into office at the next council meeting on November 18th. Early on the agenda will be the selection of one of the five of you to serve as mayor. Do any of you want to move into the mayor's job?
Well, I guess the council will decide that, right? Well, on the 17th, actually.
I guess they will.
Absolutely.
Are any of it, Shanna, are you interested in the job?
I am interested in making sure we have somebody who's going to really lead the city forward. I think I am still reeling and celebrating the results of last night and need to digest all of that. But I am looking forward to just making sure we have a good, strong leader with a strong vision.
Eric Altman, you interested?
Not this cycle.
Okay. Mark, you've been mayor before. You've served on the council before. Are you interested?
You know, I'm interested in seeing a council that moves together forward on all of the issues that East Lansing has facing it. And, you know, I think it's important to really underline the fact that this is a collegial body and that we're going to rise or fall together during the next 4 years serving together.
And specifically, Eric Altman, I know you were targeted by the mailer that was issued by the Chamber of Commerce. What impact do you think that had on the results? If I remember correctly, I seem to recall that you said that voters should interpret the chamber's opposition to you as an endorsement.
Sometimes,
am I oversimplifying that or not?
No, my response to the mailer, and it wasn't just one, there were about three by my count. They hit it pretty hard. You know, my interpretation was that I made some powerful people pretty angry. And sometimes when you do that, it's an indication that you're doing something right and you're raising issues that people don't necessarily want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And so that did not get me down. That rallied the community in a really important way to set an important precedent, which is that outsiders can't hijack our elections.
You very publicly, Mark Meadows, denounced or did not accept the endorsement of the Chamber of Commerce. Is that putting it accurately?
Well, I did. I was endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce. What I did is I denounced the negative campaigning. I don't know who was responsible for that in terms of putting that together, but putting on my old hat as chair of the House Democratic Campaign Committee, I'd say that that was a very bad decision, and it was very poorly executed to begin with. First of all, it wasn't very accurate. So, you know, as it happens, I think that the people in this community who are among the most intelligent people in the entire country rejected the idea that they were going to be led down a road of negative campaigning. It's the first time it happened in East Lansing, to my memory. And hopefully it's the last time it's going to happen.
Mark Meadows, Shanna Dreheim, and Eric Altman are our guests here on Current State. They were elected to the East Lansing City Council last night. Shanna, clarify for us why you think you were successful and what you want to accomplish on the council.
Yeah, I think I was successful. I spent a lot of time talking to voters at their doors and bringing to them what I think is a vision for the city of East Lansing. I'm very optimistic and positive about a vision for our future. And I think that resonated. I think I brought a set of expertise and skills. Even though I'm a relative newcomer, I was a Spartan, but I have only lived here for 11 years. I have deep connections in the city. And I think people knew that and understood that my vested interest in terms of really seeing this place be a world-class university town, I think that message resonated. I think people really wanted to talk about that a lot with me.
Is it important for members of the council to be on good terms with the chamber? And I feel obligated to ask that because of the role that they played this time around. Eric, is it important for you to be on good terms with the chamber? Are you going to try to get back on better terms?
The ball is in their court at this point. They made a bad decision. It's up to them to set it right.
And of course,
I'm willing to work with anybody who wants to work with the city and do good things for East Lansing, but ball's in their court.
And remind for our listeners who maybe weren't following this really closely, remind our listeners what they said that involved you.
Well, they said a lot of things that were distorted and wrong and negative about my votes and my actions in the community the past few years. And it was just a textbook, silly, negative smear campaign.
You served on a public commission, correct?
I did. I'm currently on the planning commission.
Okay.
I will have to resign that position. And I made some votes that I would make again in the same way. And once you look at the context of those votes, it's clear that I was on the same page as the city council ended up in the end, and the mailers from the Chamber of Commerce just completely distorted my record and the context.
Is there an issue? I mean, development would seem to be at the heart of or the subtext at the very least, if not the forefront of what the issues are in this election. Cut through the confusion for us here, Mark. Was the attitudes about development and incentives for developers, was that really the 800-pound gorilla in the room here during this election?
Well, I think from the point of the chamber, anyway, I would say that clearly it's the incentives that was the issue, because none of the three of us are anti-development. Obviously, we want East Lansing to move forward, development to take place and redevelopment to take place in the downtown where appropriate. I think the question was, how do you award, if you are going to award, incentives for developers to develop properties in the way that maybe we have set a vision for? And in the case of some of the development that has taken place in the downtown, I think each one of the three of us has disagreed with some of the council decisions. That doesn't mean that there won't be the use of tax increment financing in the future, but I think all of us would like to see sort of a plan set forth that talks about when and how we will determine those things so the public is more aware of what it means.
And do you think Nathan Triplett was unsuccessful last night because of his attitude toward TIFs and other incentives, Shanna?
I think that the people in this community definitely feel very strongly about TIFs. And it was, when I talked to people, you know, they had a lot of thoughts about this. But I also think, you know, they understand that sometimes this can be a really valuable economic development tool. So, but
it's
I
a
do
part
think
of the landscape.
It is. It
right?
is. It absolutely
and I,
is.
Do all of you accept that? You all accept TIFs as just part of the part of the economic development landscape?
It's one of a set of large tools that are available to municipalities mm-hmm. to encourage the right kind of development, good mm-hmm. development.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about the corner of Abbott and Grand River here. There's been several efforts at redevelopment over the years, but we're still looking at blight there. What needs to happen to jumpstart this process, assuming it needs jumpstarting? Mark Meadows?
Well, yeah, I don't know that we can call it jumpstarting. We really can't do anything with regard to that corner in terms of the development process until February, when the current owner of the property will have the opportunity to redeem from the foreclosure that took place there. I don't think that redemption will take place, primarily because the bank, the lending organization, had bid on its own foreclosure at such a high rate that it's unlikely that a developer will be able to come up with that kind of money. So we're going to probably be dealing with a new developer of some kind at that location. I think the city needs to step in and become part of that process, that negotiating process, in attracting someone to build an architecturally significant on our building on our main corner that meets all of the criteria that have been set out for diversity and age and economy and business in the downtown area.
Shanna, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's a critical space in our city. It's the gateway to our community, and we heard it resoundingly. I'd like to, you know, see us really think creatively and partner with whoever comes to the table. There's been some really interesting, you know, Mark mentioned architecturally interesting things. The Broad did this really great exhibit, and I'd love to bring us together as a community and really have that conversation about aspiration. What should that look like?
And Eric Altman, what about you?
I would echo the statements of Mark and Shanna, but I would also add that I think right now nobody really understands the posture or history of that project very well, and I think that putting together some sort of resource that's available to the public explaining the history of that project and the underlying properties would be valuable to help people understand what's happened, and would be invaluable for other potential investors and developers to figure out what they'd be getting into if they wanted to build something there.
We're talking with the three newly elected members of the East Lansing City Council, Eric Altman, Mark Meadows, and Shanna Draheim. The idea of an income tax in East Lansing has been raised. Mark Meadows, do you support instituting a city income tax?
No. You know, I thought it was interesting that there was a newspaper article that my wife said to me, "Oh, I see that you want to have an income tax." I said, "No, I didn't
you don't
say
talk about
that
this at home."
Exactly. What I said was that I felt that we should study, really, essentially any type of proposal to to increase the revenues that the city might have to provide services to its people. But I've always said, and we've studied this before, that a citywide income tax would have to be coupled with the elimination of the city's property tax for operating purposes, which is about 17.6 mils. So there would be a net positive cash flow for our citizens if that worked. We've studied it before and decided it didn't work, but I don't have a problem with studying it again.
We've been talking with Mark Meadows, Eric Altman, and Shanna Draheim, the three winners in yesterday's East Lansing City Council election. They'll be sworn into office on November 17th. Congratulations to all of you. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Glad to be
Thanks
here.
Thanks for having us.
This is WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Dr. Marcia McDowell was surrounded by quilts from the start. She says she was born with an instant quilt collection assembled by her quilting grandmothers. The quilts from McDowell's childhood bed made their way to her residence hall during her student days here at MSU. Her love and knowledge of art and textiles ultimately led to a professorship in art and art history at Michigan State and her role as folk art curator at the MSU Museum. Dr. McDowell is the author of numerous books about the art of quilts in Michigan and beyond. Marcia McDowell's most recent work with MSU's ongoing China Experience project now connects her passion for the art to people half a world away. WKAR's Peter Wharf met with McDowell earlier this week at the MSU Museum's Quilts of Southwest China exhibit to discuss the spread.
In all my years, I'd never read or heard of Chinese quilts. So what is this? And I just, from that moment on, started contacting colleagues in China, doing visits to museums, and then also going into some villages to see where production was.
This is a collection that focuses then on Southwest China.
Correct.
Where are we in this collection?
We are in Yunnan. We are in Guizhou, the Guangxi and the Yunnan nationalities museum districts in the provinces that they are situated in. Mm-hmm. So it's Southwest China.
These are at once familiar and yet very special. But maybe you can sort of describe to our listeners through shape and color and theme what's different about these quilts as opposed to what we might be more familiar with.
Basically, they're rectangular-sized bed coverings, so that much is familiar. You have a sense that, yes, those do go on beds. And they're composed of blocks of pieced-together fabric, and then there are embellishments like applique and embroidery and other techniques that are commonly used in American quilts or quilts in other places around the world. So when you look at these pieces, though, these bed covers, you go, oh, the construction format and techniques are very similar to U.S. quilts and even sometimes the designs. But then you see that these quilts are filled with all kinds of imagery and motifs that are never seen in American right. quilts. And in fact, many of the quilts here are filled with symbols and motifs that are considered auspicious.
What would some of those be? Like, for instance, I'll look at some of these quilts from a distance, and then when I come up close, some of these things will begin to reveal themselves. Dragons, birds, insects, things like that.
Exactly. And they are quite abstracted, too. You don't immediately recognize them. You have to look twice or three times to be able to see that, oh my goodness, that is actually a dragon or a phoenix or a frog or a rooster, all of which are connected to, well, the zodiac, the signs of the zodiac, or they are also considered auspicious designs in particular ethnic cultures.
Sure. Talk about some of the incredibly vivid colors that we're seeing here over on this wall directly in front of us?
Well, as you can see, the color red predominates in these textiles. And, of course, we often think of Chinese and red. So it's, I think, no surprise that red is the color that is used so frequently in these textiles. But they're often bordered with fabric that is indigo dyed blue cotton fabric, and so that dark blue indigo sets off those red central portions of the quilt in a very dramatic and, as you said, colorful way.
Right. This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm here at the MSU Museum with Professor Marcia McDowell. We're talking about the current Chinese quilt exhibit at the MSU Museum. A couple of other things that I found really fascinating here were the two videos that we're able to see two of the women who are actually making the quilts that are on display here. Talk about these videos for us.
Most of the quilts that are in this exhibition are older quilts. And however, there are a small sampling that were made recently, and three of which are connected to the artists who have been documented by our colleagues, our research colleagues at the three museums that we're working with in Southwest China. So they've sent out teams and photographed, videotaped these individual artists. And so these videos are wonderful ways to see the practice of art making right now and to hear in the artist's own words their feelings about this as a craft, as an art, as something that's important to their community. And also their worry that this is a tradition of art making that may be disappearing.
I am Mo Aichen from Sanbo.
How many children do you have?
Three, two daughters and a son.
Do your daughters learn to make quilts?
No, they don't.
They don't want to learn?
No, they went to school and work in the cities. They don't make quilts.
Do you want them to learn?
Yes, but they are not patient enough. There was no machine in the past, so the quilt was handmade. We brought quilts to our husband's house as dowry when we got married.
Did you learn from your mother?
Yes, I watched my mother and other people making quilts and learned it myself.
Yeah. What do they say about that in these videos?
Well, it's like other textile traditions around the world. These take an incredible amount of knowledge and skill to make. Knowledge and skills that have been cultivated over years of practice. And some of these textiles have taken up to a year to make. And today's younger people don't necessarily want to spend that time learning those techniques, and they have other things to do. They have universities to go to. They have jobs. They have soccer. It's the same problems that occur here in this country in terms of the younger generation learning some of these skills is happening in China.
Professor Marcia McDowell at the MSU Museum. It's a fantastic exhibit. Marcia, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our show for today. Glad you could be a part of it. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, healthcare providers say there's been a big spike in the number of minors using electronic cigarettes in recent years. The Ingham County Health Department wants to require e-cigarette vendors to obtain a tobacco license and refuse sales to those under 18. We talk with Ingham County Health Officer Linda Vail about the proposal, which could go before the county commission next week. Plus, the Lansing area is home to a diverse group of cultures, and now French culture is finding its way into the mix. We talk with Gaëlle Ross, founder of a brand new French immersion school, Au Petit Soir, about the plans for the school. All that and more Thursday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed today. Thanks to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and to Drew Hill for engineering. Never miss an episode of Current State. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts to have the latest episode delivered to your smartphone every morning. We learned yesterday that Dylan Gordon, who is a previous performer on Current State, is the recipient of a John Lennon scholarship. We're going to wrap up the program today with the track that won him the John Lennon scholarship. It's Dylan Gordon and his band Lights and Caves. We'll see you tomorrow on Current State. To carry me home.